This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
From NPR, I'm Sam Sanders. It's been a minute. Today, I want to talk about the funniest joke I have heard, or comedic bit I have heard, in maybe the last few years. It is a long riff on celebrity chef Guy Fieri.
People shit on that dude all the time. And as far as I can tell, all he ever did was follow his dreams.
That is the voice of Shane Torres. And this joke, his joke, became its own certifiable meme online. There are BuzzFeed articles about this thing. Patton Oswalt, himself a very big deal comic, he once said that Shane Torres's Guy Fieri joke is the one joke by another comic he wished he could steal. Now, the Guy Fieri joke has been in the world for a few years at this point, but I just recently discovered Shane Torres. Hi, Shane, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
How goes it?
Not too bad. How about yourself?
I saw Shane at a comedy club called Largo in L.A. a few weeks ago, and I don't usually go to comedy shows because I have no idea how to find the good ones, but some friends set this up, and I said, sure, whatever, not expecting anything.
That's the exact kind of enthusiasm we love as comedians for shows.
Shane exceeded my expectations. As soon as the show was done, I began to try to book him on this show. So Shane's at a point in his comedy career that we don't often get to hear about. He is on the road almost 250 days a year. Shane lives in New York, and sometimes there, he will do his act 15 times in a single weekend, just hopping around the different clubs and bars all across the city. We talk about what that's like in this chat. We also talk about how comedy is handling our current president. And of course, Shane and I discuss our shared Texas roots. Okay. Enjoy. So we are both from two of the same places.
Oh, yeah?
I also grew up in Texas, in San Antonio. You in Fort Worth, or the Fort Worth area.
Yeah.
And we both lived in Portland, Oregon for a while.
Did we? Wow. How about that?
How long were you in Portland?
I was there maybe 2004. So I was there like 14, 15 years ago. Yeah. Yeah, what about yourself?
I was there for a few months in 2010, and I was working for the public radio station out there, Oregon Public Broadcasting.
OPB, I love them.
You know OPB.
Yeah, you know me.
Exactly.
My mother, when I told her I was going to be on public radio once for a different thing, I had, at this point I'd done like a few big TV spots, and she was like, that's great. But when I told her I was going to be on NPR for another thing I did, she lost her mind, like, and then
really?
Like, yeah, and then OPB, she's, yeah, it was very,
I love
it. It was very cute. It was very cute old Irish lady thing to do.
Oh, so your mother's Irish.
Yeah.
And your last name is Torres. Is your father Latino?
Yeah, my father was a first generation Mexican American, and my mother was from Southern Ireland.
That must have made for a fun household.
Yeah, well, when they were together.
Okay. Was there... I found myself when I was thinking about comparing life in Texas to life in Portland, Oregon, it's really different experiences. I mean, one place is just inherently more liberal than the other, and like the other place, but it's weird. Like, Portland is more liberal, but also more white. Like, I saw fewer brown people up there.
Oh, for sure.
It was so, but it was like full of these really earnest and nice white people, like, they really wanted to be your friend, but I was like, where are the blacks?
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody, I am white, more or less, you know, like, so, like, I guess with me, people, like, look at me and they're like, oh, I forget you're Mexican sometimes.
I totally assumed you were Latina. That's funny.
Yeah, yeah, well, like, I think a lot of, you know, but...
Texans probably see you differently, because, you know.
Yeah, because it's different. The contrast was, I don't know maybe if you felt this way or not, but, like, when I got there, I was just like, some of this is wonderful, and this is, like, what I've been looking for. So that was, like, part of it. But then part of it, I was like, this is too liberal.
Explain.
Like, there was a strip joint, like, 10 feet from a high school. You know, because there's not, like, they have, like, extremely liberal, like, zoning laws in that city.
And it's, like, the strip club capital of the country.
Yeah.
More there per capita than any place.
I went to plenty of them. But I was just like, this seems like, you know, a lot.
Yeah. Do you miss Texas at all?
Texas, yeah, I do. But it's not the same place to me that it was when I grew up.
Explain.
There, I'm just grown. I've been gone for 15 years. My life is, I've been gone... two-thirds of the time I'd lived there. And it's just like, you know, like I have a few friends that I'm still very close to there, and then my brothers live there. But I don't ever see myself settling there or anything like that.
I would go back.
You would?
Yeah. I think what I like
about San Antonio?
Somewhere around there.
San Antonio is a great city, man.
San Antonio's hella cool.
Man, I was there. I was playing the improv there.
It's a good vibe.
I crushed some Mexican food. I was killing it.
Listen. That's what I miss. Also, it's like, I don't know, I compare Texas to California. Like, it's a state that's too big and too diverse to put in any one box. Like,
yeah.
And that's what I like about it. Like, you drive 2 hours east, 2 hours west, you're in a different climate with different people wherever
yeah,
you go.
And,
like,
yeah,
that's cool.
And that is cool. And you get to meet, but they're all still very Texan.
There is this wild, rabid allegiance to the state.
Yeah.
Like, I'll never not claim Texas and, like, defend Texas.
Yes. I got a lot more intense about being from Texas the moment people started being like, about people from Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also moved when Bush 2 was still in office. So I had a lot of, like, you know, like, pigeonholing done my way.
Yeah. Which is so annoying. And this is the thing. It's like, liberals do it to conservatives and vice versa. It's not like one side is better about doing that. Yeah, everyone just wants to pigeonhole and typecast.
It's crazy how, like, okay people are with something as long as they agree with the person doing it.
Yeah, that's like the whole state of our politics right now.
Yeah.
Man, do you joke about politics on stage?
Not really. I mean...
Why not?
One, I don't know if I'm informed enough. And two, I don't know if I could write a good enough... informed enough to write a joke that somebody else couldn't tell.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, and that's...
I also feel like they
come to laugh, and politics are extremely divisive now more than other time in my life.
Well, and then there's so many comics that I'll see on TV or online or whatever. They think just dunking on Trump and saying he's awful is a joke. That's not a joke.
No, it's lazy.
That's not smart. This is the thing. I feel like so much of the comedy surrounding the president and our politics right now is just lazy.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I think there's some people who do brilliant stuff about the president and about politics right now, and, like, young people, not just established political comedians.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are some people who just happen to have a Twitter following and do it.
Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know. There are a lot of funny people who are funny.
Yeah.
And they've just devoted half of their lives and their brain space to, like, crapping on Trump every day. And I'm like, sure, you can do that, whatever you want. But, like, gosh, I really liked it when you were funny. I missed that.
And I'm not the first person to say this, and nor will I be the last, but it's not brave for you to go into your room at an alternative comedy show and have an opinion that the rest of the room has.
Come on. Exactly.
It's lazy, and you're not being an artist. You're not being creative. What you're being is unoriginal and slow to form.
Well, I also, like, I wonder, there is a little more tone policing than I'm used to seeing around the world of comedy and what y'all get to say and not
People are trying. Some people are still doing it because of it, you know. Like, I have a thing where I talk about, since so many comics lately have been Me Too'd and outed, and I have a bit where I talk about what it sucks, how it hurts to lose somebody you really admire in that light.
Who have you lost that you admire?
You know, like, I grew up on The Cosby Show. Like, that was, like, a, you know, an important thing to me. And now, you know, like, I can't, and for good reason. I'm not, like, you know, like, I'm not advocating that everybody still gets royalties. I'm not a, you know.
I mean, it would be nice to see, like, Felicia Rashad still get royalties because she didn't do anything, you know.
Yeah, but yeah, yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
But the point being that, like, it's weird to lose that. Same thing with Louis. Same thing with Ryan Adams. Like, all these people some of them make great art, and if you want to have the integrity say you're going to have, you don't get to absorb it anymore.
Yeah.
Or you need to, like,
yeah,
figure out a way how you can justify it.
I'm going to ask you the question I've asked every comic that's come on my show in the last, like, year, especially the male comics. Do you think it's gone too far? Me too, in the comedy world.
I think at points I have thought that, for sure. And then I, at the same time, I have been proven over and over again that, you know, maybe it hasn't gone far enough. Mm. I, you know, I've seen some behavior where I look at guys and I'm like, oh, man, I didn't think that was that bad. Or, you know, and now, mm-hmm. like, I'm a little more
aware. Well, because, like, we're men and they're not creeping on us, so we don't have to see it.
Yeah. So you look at yourself and that's good. You need to.
That's the thing. It's like, I think a lot of men specifically feel like the movement has gone too far because they're having to ask themselves a lot of uncomfortable questions. But, like, the point is for you to ask yourself a lot of uncomfortable questions.
Yeah, for sure. And we need to still be doing that. And I think the pendulum swung really hard in one direction, and now it's coming back the other way a little bit because it has to – you have to go too far to make some change, I think, if that makes sense. Like, you need to
– Yeah,
maybe not too far, but, like, you need to make a blunt –
you got to go hard.
Yes, you have to make a blunt impact. You can't be – if you're going to make change, you can't be offering concessions out of the gate.
You can't just ask for it and say, maybe a little bit of change, please. Yeah, it's got to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, you got to be hard-nosed about it. So I can respect that. Yeah.
Well, I also, like, I wonder, like, part of the work is clearing out these awful men, but part of the work is changing the culture of comedy so it's not just a boys' club. And I don't think that anyone's figured that out yet. Do you think that is changing?
Probably not fast enough, but I do. And I see it. I see it when I'm booked on shows. Lineups are more diverse. People have to be more holy minded about it. Like, mm-hmm. one, because they get called out for it. And that's probably a reason a lot of people do it.
Yeah.
You know, but I do think it's changing.
All right, time for a break. When we come back, Shane's famous Guy Fieri bit and what it reveals about comedy writ large. BRB.
Support for NPR and the following message come from RCA Records, presenting Pink's new album, Hurts to Be Human, featuring the hit songs Walk Me Home, Hurts to Be Human featuring Khalid, Hustle, Can We Pretend featuring Cash Cash, and more. Pink's new album, Hurts to Be Human, available everywhere now.
Listeners, if you love It's Been a Minute, and I hope you do, then you should check out Life Kit. It is a show with tools to help you get it together. Think of it as that friend who always has great advice on everything from how to invest to how to get a great workout. Subscribe now to Life Kit All Guides so you can get episodes on every topic all in one place. You can find Life Kit in your podcast app or at npr.org/lifekit.
I heard you do this Guy Fieri bit when I saw you, and I was like, oh, my God, this is the best thing in the world.
Did I do that? I didn't do that at Largo.
I swear you did it.
Maybe you Googled it or YouTube, because I don't think
I Googled afterwards. Well, anyways,
I'm not doing that one anymore. Okay.
You still could know people love it. Anyways, backstory.
Yeah. Sorry, I just get to, you know, like, it's a.
I know. Yeah, you don't want to have your whole life defined as being the Guy Fieri comic.
Yeah. But unless I get a cut, yeah.
Maybe they will. So yeah. I guess just set this up. I went home, I guess, that night, Googled you, found the Guy Fieri bit, and I was like, the whole world needs to know about this. And then I realized that kind of the whole world does. You first made this joke or did this bit, what, in 2017, if not before?
Yeah.
And like, then you end up doing it on Conan, and then it's part of your special. I want to play a bit of it because, like, there's so much to unpack in it, and I know you're tired of doing this, and I know you have talked about this joke forever. We're just going to do a little bit just for me.
Oh, it's fine.
He started a company where he hires everybody. He pays more than minimum wage. He gives health benefits before he has to. He has a nonprofit where he gives pretzel-making machines to schools so they can fundraise. I know that one sounds like I made it up, but I swear to Christ, it's true. He works with Special Olympics athletes, and if you need a little more sugar with this medicine, he also officiated a gay wedding. Yeah. But because he has flames on his shirt, everybody... it's all over this dude like he's a member of Nickelback. And by the way, what the hell did Nickelback ever do?
So the whole bit is basically like, why is everyone so mean to Guy Fieri, the celebrity chef we all love to hate? Did you expect it to have such legs?
I thought it might do well, like, on social media and stuff, but I didn't, like, think, I wasn't, like, ready to make memes about it or anything like that. You know, I just thought, like, I was proud of the bit, and I knew it was working when I was making it.
Yeah.
And I knew I was right, which was the other thing. And I also know, like, every joke about Guy Fieri is easy, you know, yeah. like, yeah.
It's also very classist. Like,
yeah, yeah.
The like, quote unquote, normal people like Guy Fieri, which is even more reason for like some people to hate him.
Yeah. The world is such a nasty place right now, and everybody's ready to dump on it. There's a point where, like, negativity just became a valid form of opinion without having any substance behind it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's just that was just an easy place to make that point.
Do you think that thread of the culture is getting better, this, like, just being mean to nice people just because you can? Are we moving past that, or have we just doubled down on our Guy Fieri-hatingness?
I don't know, man. It's, I don't know if it's getting better or worse, but... it's definitely not gone. I know that.
Do you think comics can play a part in making it better? I find myself thinking philosophically about like the role of comedy and jokes in such a kind of divided moment. Like, I do think like some of the work of uniting the country again, or at least calming things down, it is not going to come from our politics or in politicians. It's going to come from like the art makers and the culture makers and the taste makers and, like, the comics.
Yes, I do think comedians will do that. But I also, I do think there's, a, like, until you see somebody making a good joke about some conservative pundit on SNL that is, like, thoughtful and paints them in a good light. You know, like, not that there are many of them or anything. Well, the point I'm trying to make is, like, when you make mean jokes about people, even if you are right, it doesn't do anything to get them to change their mind.
You and it's just not helping like the culture writ large.
Yeah, yeah. So, like,
you aren't
like I'm not saying
this.
I want to see Tucker Carlson as the host of SNL, but...
well, now that you say it, I do.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that would be funny.
It might be pretty funny. Like, just a weird immersion therapy for, like, the media elite markets. but, like, they probably don't feel like they get that voice, you know, like, across in their entertainment and their comedy. Mm-hmm. Like, conservatives, I mean. And... you still need to be responsible with it. It's still, I don't know, man.
Well, for me, it's like a lot of the things that I'm saying to myself now. It's like, all right, everyone is in this place in the culture where everyone wants to do everything they can do because they can. But people are not thinking about whether or not they should, what they should be doing. Like, is your set elevating the discourse? Is that joke helpful to the dialogue? Is the work I'm doing on my show, is it making us angrier or calming things down? You know,
yeah.
Like, I
or
can't
is it just
make
about
every...
you.
Exactly.
Yeah. But you still need to relate yourself and your creativity because that's what is good about it for you.
Yeah.
That's very,
but there is
a fine
this
line.
Yeah. Well, there's this lack of a feeling of creative responsibility, I think. Everyone
yeah.
is out for themselves right now.
Yeah. And everybody's trying to get theirs.
Has Guy called you, Guy Fieri?
He did. Yeah. Well, he did. Yeah.
Well, how does
Guy
Fieri
like
say hello? Really? It took him a year?
Yeah.
How does Guy Fieri say hello?
He's busy. He's a pretty busy guy.
Yeah. He has like a bajillion restaurants.
Yeah. It was weird because it was very short, but it was very thoughtful. He called me. I was on a flight, and we were pushing back from the gate. Uh-huh.
Perfect time to call, Guy.
I got a call from like an L.A. number, and I was like, oh, maybe this is somebody calling about the gig I'm going to or something. Mm-hmm. And I picked it up and I was like, what's up, TJ? Because I thought it was my agent. And he goes, hi, and I was like, who's this? And he goes, it's Shane Torsner. I was like, who's calling, please? And he goes, it's Guy. And I'm like, who? And he goes, it's Guy Fieri. And I just started laughing really loud. And,
on the plane.
Yeah, yeah. And then the guy next to me was like looking at me, and the stewardess was like, you need to get off your phone. I'm like, hey, man, this is him. What's up? I was like, it's cool you to call. And he was just very sweet. He was like, hey, I really appreciate it. And he's like, you need to keep kicking ass. He's like, we got a lot to talk about. He's like, he's very busy, but it was a very sincere, I felt, call, and that he took the time to do it.
All right, time for one more break. In a moment, we'll talk about Shane's life on the road and the unexpected place his performing career began.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
This message comes from the BBC with Where to Be a Woman. Join hosts Saatchi Kaul and Sophia Smith-Gaylor to find out where in the world women can live their best lives. Search for Where to Be a Woman from BBC Podcasts.
Every 6 hours, a new dollar store opens up in the U.S. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, and on the latest Planet Money, are there too many dollar stores? Some cities want to ban them.
I've never said we don't want any. I've said we have too many.
That's on Planet Money.
How often are you on the road right now?
I did 240 days last year.
Dude.
Yeah.
Is it only domestic, or are you abroad as well?
A little bit. I mean, like, can you call Calgary abroad?
Yeah, sure, why not?
And I was in Dublin last year. And
okay, no, that's definitely abroad.
Yeah.
240 nights a year. So you're
that was
on
last
an average
year.
Week. That was last year. But okay, so then on average, how many shows a week?
It's weird because the shows vary in length and time and stuff. Like, I think I'm home in New York this week, and I have 15 sets this week.
What?
That's
crazy.
That's not even, I would say, that doesn't even put me in the top 20 of guys of comics in New York who do spots. I would say there's guys who, there's probably 50 or 60 more people at least that do that more spots than that a week.
Okay, 15 sets a week. That's like
two
three
a night.
Two a night? So at different clubs, same club or what?
Both, you know, you bounce around. Like, the clubs have more stage time to offer, and that's great. But then you also, you know, like, there's bar shows in Brooklyn, and like, you know, and like the other thing is, like, when I'm on the road, if I'm headlining a club, I'm doing an hour. I'm not doing 15 minutes, which is like what you're doing most, about the max amount of time you're going to be doing in the city. So if you're doing an hour, that's, in the sense of time, that's four sets, if you're like looking at it that way. I'm not doing 15 one-hour sets in a week. You know, I'm doing 10, 15-minute spots in a week, and then I might go on the road like Thursday through Saturday and do two shows Friday, Saturday, and one on Thursday. It'd be doing 45 minutes to an hour each night.
So do you like that schedule, that pace? It sounds hectic to me.
It's very – I like being – I'm a fan of working a lot. Sorry. Like
snaps.
it makes me happy.
Yeah.
Like, I took last night off, and my roommate got home at 9:30. One of them, she's like, what the hell are you doing here? and it was great, but it's –
What's a night off for you look like?
Vegging out hard.
What do you
like I'm taking up the whole sofa, and I'm watching Friday Night Lights or Billions, and then
Billions was so good.
Oh yeah, have you watched it last night?
No.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what happens this week. They go to a
no.
But yeah, like the night off, man, or it's like, you know, and I still like to work when I'm home. You know, even if it just be emailing, like trying to get spots for the coming weeks.
Yeah. When did you decide that you were funny?
I don't know. I think I'm getting good at it.
But there's always a moment when you're, like, young and you say, I'm going to do comedy now. You have to say to yourself, well, I'm funny enough to do this. When did you start knowing that you could make
people laugh?
I think
a lot of times in comedy, when people think I'm funny enough to do this, is because they're looking at somebody be bad at it.
Did that happen
for you? I
don't
know if it's the correct bar for entry. You know, like,
is that
should be one of the... I mean, I could think of one guy that I was like,
say it out
he's
loud.
Here every. I was like, no, I'd be like, he's here every week, and he gets up, and then you look at people who do comedy forever, and they just bomb and bomb, but they just need
keep
it.
Keep doing it.
Yeah, and that I can't hate on them for it.
What about comedy called you? Because I read that in college you were studying like vocal performance.
Okay, I don't know what your sources are, but you should probably reveal them.
So you were. I'm not lying.
No, you weren't lying. But
you got really defensive about that,
yeah,
sir.
I'm very touchy about that, man.
I'm not going to make you sing if you don't want to sing. It's okay.
I'm right, you're not. okay. So I'm like a big music guy. I like a lot of music.
What kind of music were you? Well, one, what's your instrument?
Well, my instrument was singing, and I played a little guitar, but I was bad at both. Like, I just loved music. I got very into music when I was in high school.
What genre?
Like metal and punk. My friends were punkers, and I listened to a lot of metal. And then, also, I just like rock, anything rock, indie rock stuff.
You know, there are a lot of rock music singers that don't take vocal performance in college. You really went all the way in.
I wanted to, but I was in a band that was they were good and I was terrible. One of the things with music is it's such an identifier when you're young, and it gives you a persona.
Oh yeah,
yeah, because you don't you think you have an I you like. You want to be like that because that person looks cool to you.
Well, they teach you how to be, you know?
Yeah,
the musicians
yeah.
teach you how to, like, inhabit a certain space.
Yeah, and they invoke tone and, you know, yeah. like in so many ways, and you identify with it. So, like, I was like, I loved music, and these guys played instruments, and I was like, well, I'll be in your band, and they're like, great, you know, and then that turned out not to be such a great idea. You know, and then I just, like, I found comedy the same time I was in college in Portland, and I was like, this fits me better. I don't want to go to school anymore.
And how did you find it? Was it, like, a moment, a night, a set?
Oh, yeah. There were a few of them. I remember I walked in. Do you know the Baghdad Theater on Hawthorne?
Yeah.
Yeah, they used to have comedy nights there. Mm-hmm. So it was this big, like, 400-seater theater, mm-hmm. right? But on late shows Friday, mm-hmm. they would do them at, like, 10:30. There'd be, like, 30 people in this tavern.
That's demoralizing.
Yeah, and comics would be there. And there were all these. I had a Friday night off, uh-huh. and I walked into the show, and I was like, this was, you know, a while ago, but I was, like, watching these comics, and I was like, my God, these guys are just different than anything I'd seen. Mm. Like, they were alt comics. There was a guy named Andy Wood who he created the Bridgetown Comedy Festival in Portland. Mm-hmm. There was a guy named Richard Bain who I ended up living with a bit. I mean, he was one of the most naturally gifted, funny people I'd ever seen. Mm. There are these people there. Christine Levine was one of them. These people would just rip and not afraid. Like, and they weren't like, so often in comedy, you see people doing an impression of what they think comedy should look like, whether it be a specific comic or the idea of acting like, you know, like a late night comedian, like, hey, snapping mm-hmm. their fingers or whatever, or people doing Hedberg or Bamford or all these other people. Like, they're just doing, and I get it, you know, you get influences. That's how you start in anything. Like, you don't write a great song at first, you learn to play Nevermind. So, but like, you know, like, but I saw them. And my basis of comedy at that point was pretty broad in the sense of, like, Cosby, Hicks, and Chappelle. Like, you know, all very famous comedians. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, like, they were doing this thing. I was like, oh, my God, these guys are incredible. And I was like, I always did like comedy. Maybe I should try getting back into that.
So then you decide to do it, and, like, things kind of work out for you. I mean, I know there's a path and a journey that takes time, and you bomb a lot, whatever, whatever, whatever. But, like, you ended up, like, on Last Comic Standing, that reality show for comics, which was, like, a pretty big deal, no?
Yeah.
it is.
Well, like, yes and no.
Okay.
It is. It absolutely is.
And, like, Roseanne has given you notes on the show. That's a big deal.
Yeah. That seemed like would have meant a lot more about a year ago.
Well. Touche.
I mean, but does it? You know, it doesn't mean she still doesn't know what she's talking about as a stand-up comedian. You know,
she knows the craft.
Yeah, you know, like, I mean, I know all this stuff about Louis, but you can't tell me everybody didn't love his for a while.
What notes did Roseanne give you?
She said more growth, more time, which she was actually right about. I did that show. They never aired my set. I remember.
Wait, they never aired your set?
No. That happens to so many comics. I do remember this was one of the most embarrassing moments I've ever had in comedy.
Tell me.
I got an email from the producers of the show. They're like, hey, you're going to be on the show tonight. They were doing this thing like top 100 jokes mm-hmm. of the show. And I was like, oh, well, great. I'm going to be on. So I told everybody, I put it on social media. I was like, guys, watch tonight. I'm going to be on Last Comic Standing.
Yeah.
And they count down from 100 jokes or 50 jokes or whatever it was. Uh-huh. And then the lower it got, like at first I was like, oh, this is good. I wasn't 50. You know?
Yeah.
And then I got to 10. I was like, top 10. Way to go, Torres.
Look at you, Shane Torres, top 10. Yes.
And then we got down to number 2, and I was like, oh, no.
Maybe like, you were number 1?
Yeah, and then my buddy Ian Carmel, he's a writer on James Corden now. He's
oh,
a good
I've
friend.
Seen him do a set downtown.
He's wonderful. Yeah,
he's really funny.
Yeah, he's like one of my best friends. We live together.
Huh.
He looked at me, he goes, I guess this means you're number 1. And I was like, I don't think that. He goes, I was just being nice. And then sure enough, then I was like, hey, I just want to know. I wrote him. I was like, just want to know what happened. You guys told me I was going to be on the show. And they're like, oh, yeah, you said something about something we couldn't get past censor. And I was just like,
no.
So I have like a mixed relationship with them.
Yeah. Shane Torres, I really appreciate your work and your time today. And I'm a fan.
Thanks for taking the time to have me.
All right.
Take care.
Bye.
Many thanks to Shane Torres. As we said, he's on the road all the time, Wisconsin, Illinois, Nevada, Michigan, all those places real soon. Shane also has a comedy album out. It is called Established 1981. You can find that on Spotify or wherever you stream your stuff. Okay, listeners, Friday is coming very soon. It's always coming very soon. It happens once a week. But that means you have another chance to share with me the best thing that happened to you all week. Just record yourself and email that audio file to me at samsanders@npr.org. samsanders@npr.org. You might hear yourself in Friday's show. All right, until then, thank you for listening. I'm Sam Sanders. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology. Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.